Welcome back to Fear or Favour. So, Nazir, we're going to talk about the police officers whose identity was withheld for a significant period of time. And then we're going to talk in some real detail about Levi Belfield and the recent announcement that he has possibly confessed to the murder of Lynn and Megan Russell. How are you?
I'm good. I'm all right. We're at war, but apart from that, everything's fine.
Yeah, it's pretty serious, isn't it?
I know. I woke up with something in your stomach telling you things aren't good. You know, we're obviously talking about things that really matter, but you know, when you have a European country under attack, everything else goes into perspective, doesn't it, really?
No, absolutely. So let's start with these police officers. So three police officers, two of them still serving, allegedly shared racist and misogynistic text in relation to the former police officer who was prosecuted, cousins, and convicted in relation to the murder of Sarah Everard. Now, initially, these police officers have had their identity withheld, and the reason given by the prosecutors was that it might prejudice a trial. I just don't buy that.
No. I mean, they gave a number of reasons. It's the usual thing, isn't it? They also said for their welfare. Well, you could say that about any accused person. You know, once their name gets out there, once they've been charged, you know, somebody might not be happy with them. I think that's possibly what they meant by their welfare. And whether, how would it prejudice an investigation or a prosecution? Their names. I mean, we do not have secret justice in this country. You know, anybody that is charged with an offence, we can come on to whether they should be named while they're being investigated, but anybody that's been charged with an offence should automatically be named, because you know the reality is that they now face public proceedings. And again, it gives this impression, doesn't it, that there's one rule for some and another rule for others. It gives the impression that police officers are above the law, which clearly they're not. And I think it can do nothing but damage confidence. Of course, they revisited the decision a few days later and said, okay, here's their names. I think they were forced to do that. They didn't do that voluntarily, willingly. And I suspect even when they had appeared at the court, the magistrate would have ordered their names be released anyway. That's happened in other instances. So why? I keep asking myself, why? Why do something that just gives people cause for concern?
And the policy from policing council is that after charge, name will be released unless there's exceptional circumstances for that name to be withheld. And of course, in this case, they made an argument there was exceptional circumstances. I don't believe that. You don't believe that. But it does go to the heart of this whole issue about confidence in the police. And if the police are in a position where they're going to effectively ride roughshod over some of the policies that exist and try and look after their own, because that's how it's seen, it never comes over well for the public, does it?
No, not in the slightest. I think that when you've got police officers who allegedly have committed quite a heinous crime in the eyes of the British public, you've got to be even more open and even more transparent rather than suggesting the opposite. Now, what I said earlier on about what happens when somebody has been arrested is actually newsworthy, because there was a Supreme Court decision in relation to a case brought against Bloomberg. Bloomberg, the agency, had wanted to name a suspect before charge. And the Supreme Court said there has to be a good public interest in naming somebody. So, in effect, they were saying the default should be that you don't name a suspect until such time as they are charged. That has caused major ructions, particularly in our media and our newspaper industry. Because it's bread and butter for them to say Mark has been arrested, Nazir has been investigated. It's bread and butter for them to do that. Now suddenly it would appear, unless that decision is qualified in some way, that they are not able to name somebody. And again, it goes to the point about secret justice, Mark.
Yeah.
You know?
We have one of the best criminal justice systems in the world. And I always say this, and I've traveled the world, and I'm sure you have, certainly in terms of policing wise. And I've looked at many different police forces, you know, processes. And I have to say, amongst with the Americans as well, I hold the Americans very high in their criminal justice system, certainly in terms of policing. I think we have one of the best in the world. But when you have a situation where there is lack of transparency from the very people who are there to uphold the law, you have a major problem.
Yeah. I mean, the CPS are meant to be independent, or they are independent of the police. They're meant to put the public's interest first. And therefore, somebody should have been knocking on somebody's door and saying, what the hell are you doing?
Mm. You know, do you think the CPS can be? Do you think the CPS are truly independent?
Yeah, well, I worked for them for 25 years. Mm. And I can assure you, absolutely, independence is a state of mind. I never allowed anybody to sway my decision or judgment. What was important is that I got as much information as possible. So yeah, absolutely, you rely upon the police for that information and that intelligence and that evidence. At the end of the day, the decision is the prosecutor's. So, yeah, absolutely, they are independent. However, it's perception. Perception now is that there will be occasions, and this is another one of them, where they are doing somebody else's bidding. You know, yeah. That may not be the reality. I hope it's not the reality. But it gives the perception. And, of course, perception becomes people's reality. They don't know what to – you know, we've discussed before that levels of trust – in institutions right now in this country are really low. Well, here's some more evidence to that effect.
Yeah, because, of course, one of the problems for police force, for the Crown Prosecution Service, is that police forces will feed them information. Now, if that information is incredibly one-sided and doesn't have all of the information there, the Crown Prosecutor can only make the decision on the information they're being given.
Yes. Yeah, we weren't allowed to investigate. That's not our job. The police do the investigation, but you can guide them and advise them. I mean, this is what I used to do quite a lot of. You know, officers would come with half the case, I guess, and we would say to them, right, if you do this, this, and this, that would make the case stronger. If you do this, this, and this, it might end up being weaker. And so you do guide them, and that's a clear role for an independent prosecution service, but. You know, when they actually start doing the bidding, if that's the perception anyway, of the police or of another institution, say government, then they damage confidence. And I'm afraid that's a really bad place.
Yeah. And what worried me about the statement from the Crown Prosecutor was that they felt that it prejudiced a trial by associating the individuals, the three officers, with cousins. Now, that just doesn't make any sense because that information is going to come out at the trial.
Yeah, the evidence
anyway.
Will be heard before the jury if it goes to a jury. You know, the jury are going to find out anyway.
It makes no sense from the prosecutor's point of view. You know, for the prosecutor, even if we said, you know, they're independently sitting there and they're just being given information by the police, that's a Crown Prosecutor making a statement which doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't make any sense. And as I said, they gave a multitude of reasons. The other one was about the welfare of the suspects, i.e. somebody might try and harm them in some way,
yeah,
and to give them an opportunity to put something in place to protect them. You know, I can understand that, but these are police officers. They've been on bail for a while. They've been under investigation for a while. I am pretty sure that any welfare issues should and could have been addressed prior to the decision to charge. So, as I said, it doesn't add up. And if it doesn't add up, if I don't think it adds up and you don't think it adds up, what do you think our listeners are going to think?
Yeah.
You know? It is another shameful episode in how to not prosecute or investigate a case.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's move on to the big subject, which is Levi Belfield. He now calls himself Yusuf Rahim. He is serving two whole life sentences for the murder of Marsha McDonald, Amelia Delagrange, Millie Dowler, and the attempted murder of Kate Sheedy. He's now been linked to the murders of Lynn and her daughter, Megan Russell, who were killed in July 1996. That case became known as the Chillenden Murders, a savage attack beaten with a hammer. There is a man in jail for their murder, Michael Stone. He'd been found guilty twice in relation to the murder, and he's serving three life sentences. He has, from day one, maintained that he is innocent. There's a confession, or that's at least what we're being told, a confession. And I've got a little bit more of an insight into this, is that it's all come about because during Belfield's time in jail, he has been speaking to a psychiatrist, psychologist, counselor, whatever it is. And part of that treatment process is that he needs to admit offences have occurred in the past. And it's alleged that he's created a confessional. Now, some of the extracts of that confessional are very telling. And let me read some of them. I was wearing bright yellow marigold washing up gloves and holding a hammer in my right hand. In my car, I had a screwdriver, a lock knife, a hammer, yellow marigold gloves, and a very long black bootlace. My first intention was just to attack Lynn, but I quickly changed my mind due to the screams and was worried that she would fight back given the children were with her. I approached Lynn and held her right arm tight. She asked me not to harm her children. She was calm. Had she screamed, I would have attacked her and left not harming the children. The situation just got out of control, and the more she complied, it just gave me more confidence. I walked all three of them off the track. I forced Lynn to sit down. So that's obviously a massive, massive admission, if that's true. Mm. The police have responded. So Detective Chief Superintendent Paul Fotherington from Kent Police has said, following two trials at which Stone was found guilty by a jury on both occasions and an appeal to the High Court, Stone remains convicted of the murders of Lynn and Megan Russell and the attempted murder of Josie Russell. Michael Stone has made an application to apply for a judicial review in respect of his conviction in September 2012, and Mr. Justice Blake ordered that permission for the application should be refused. The Criminal Case Review Commission commenced an extensive re-examination of the murder investigation in 2017 and has access to all forensic evidence, documentation exhibits from the original investigation. The review by Hampshire Police, details of the two Crown Court trials and appeals by the High Court. Basically, they're saying they do not believe that there is sufficient evidence and he has been convicted twice in a court. So where does this leave us? So Belfield is a liar, isn't he?
Well, he lied during the trials. He has lied pretty much all of his life, given what we know about him. I always have an issue with confessions that are made in prison or whether they're not given at the time or whether they're not given in the presence of police officers, etc., etc. And people do have an agenda. And we're talking about Belfield, who's an arch manipulator. I mean, he's manipulated the system for a long, long time, which enabled him to get away or try to get away with the murders that he was convicted of. So I am less enamored with his confession than I would be otherwise if it was somebody else. Generally, when you get a confession like this, you then try, as an investigator or a prosecutor, you then try and look, is there anything in what he says that isn't in the public domain? Now, the Stone trial trials have been very publicly aired, haven't they, Mark? And So the terrible, terrible events that led to the murders are out there. You know, you can find them in any way, shape, or form. And so it's not that difficult for somebody to take some of the information that's in the public domain and present it in the way they do. And, you know, when you've got a narcissist and an attention seeker like Belfield, a liar like Belfield, who clearly wants to feel relevant, who clearly wants people to remember him, his legacy is the people he's killed, then it does not surprise me that he might want to do this. Now, it doesn't mean that it's not true. There is evidence to suggest, for example, that he probably wasn't around. He couldn't have been around at the time these murders took place. But anyway, it needs to be investigated like anything else. And I think that first step would be for the police to interview him in prison in order to satisfy themselves that what he is saying to them has any credibility whatsoever. As it currently stands, I don't find it very credible, I'm afraid. That's not to say that Michael Stone is guilty. I mean, well, he is guilty. He's been convicted twice. But, you know, they're two different things. Michael Stone can, if further evidence comes to light, get a referral to the Criminal Cases Review Commission and then go back to the Court of Appeal, if that's what happens. They're two completely different things in my mind. What Belfield did or didn't do is one thing. What Stone did or didn't do is another thing. But what really irks me is that, you know, when you were just rehearsing the facts of these terrible murders, is I worry for the families of the deceased. Mm. You know, you know, when you've dealt with families of bereaved families, I have too. They get some closure at the end of a case. Some, not a lot, some closure. And then suddenly, years later, there it is again, back in the news, being rehearsed in the ways that it has done. It brings back all those terrible memories of the original loss. You know, I really do feel for them.
Yeah, I mean, I think the family is such an important thing because we're talking, you know, well and truly 20 years later, a case that they considered all to be solved is back up in the headlines, and it brings everything back up again, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, and Josie, who of course survived the murders of
Lynn, now an adult.
Lynn and Megan. Yeah, absolutely. You know, all I know is, look, let's let it follow due process. I'm afraid, you know, I've had a lot of convicted murderers who suddenly just think, well, I'm not in the news today. I need to be in the news. Let me admit to something else. We talked before about the 3,000 or so unsolved murders in this country. So there are people, I'm afraid, who get off on this kind of thing.
And he's always craved publicity, hasn't he, Belfield? Belfield has always been a person that wants to be in the headlines. I know when I did the recent investigation into Sutcliffe, one of the things that we did get is audio recordings of Belfield in jail talking to Sutcliffe. And he always wanted to be the centre of attention. And in fact, Belfield got quite frustrated at times when Sutcliffe was attracting more attention than him. And I think that goes to the heart of a lot of Belfield's communication. He circulates a lot of stuff externally outside the prison through friends and family. He's also a man who is shown to be a pathological liar. And as a result of that, it's very difficult to take something from this. And the point you made right at the very beginning is that this has been through two trials. All the information that is available has been put into the public domain. So it's not as though if you want to find something out about the case, even if it's minutiae detail, you can find that because it is available. So it would be very difficult from an investigative point of view to find a piece of information that is absolutely unique that nobody else publicly knows about. Something that happens a lot more in America than in the UK is confessionals, isn't it? What's the view in terms of the Crown Prosecution Service around dealing with confessionals?
Well, there was a time when we were very keen on them. Police were too. It meant that you could close lots of cases, couldn't you? But I think people have become much more circumspect about these things. A realization that actually people might be doing it for their own agenda, and of course recognizing the impact on victims and victims' families. So I think we've got to be mindful that people have their, you know, in this case, we've got a liar, a narcissist, attention seeker, making a confession. It may or may not be true. We'll find that in due course. But what's important is that you open your eyes when you hear a confession like this. You don't simply accept it at face value.
It reminds me of the policing days of the 70s, 80s and 90s, you know, prior to Pace, where there weren't interviews recorded, audio. They were written down. And we had an awful lot of confessionals in those periods of times where people would admit to a crime. The officer would write down in transcript, paper format, and there would be in confession. And actually, more recently, certainly since Pace, has been much more of a reluctance to accept a confession without other supporting evidence. Yeah. Because, of course, what we do know, and every murder inquiry I've ever worked on, certainly the high-profile ones, mainly, it's amazing the amount of people that will come forward and actually admit to an offence. I mean, there's many major crimes that I've dealt with, certainly as far as murder goes, where people have come into a police station or made contact and said, I'd like to tell you about something I've done, and you know, I admit to that crime, but they've got nothing to do with it.
We had a culture, didn't we? We heard the word TIC. We know what the word, a matter taken into consideration. And what was happening routinely, Mark, as you know, is that somebody would be convicted of, say, burglary. And then an officer would go in to see them after they're being convicted with a long list of outstanding burglaries in the area and say to them, right, did you do this? Did you do this? Did you do this? And they'd go, well, why should you admit to it? They said, well, look, if you admit to it, you don't get any additional sentence.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're actually, you know, because you've been so open, you might get a reduced sentence. And so you'd have one burglary, 25 TICs, matters taken into consideration. The police, it's a win-win for them because they've, quote unquote, written off, solved a burglary. The suspect thinks he's got a slight discount because he's been so open and honest. Who do you think has lost? You, the victims, the public have lost, and justice's system has lost as well, because there's a burglar still out there doing burglars.
Yeah.
Hasn't been brought to justice. And so that culture is one that we've tried so hard to get rid of. But I imagine, you know, Christmas has come early if somebody comes along and confesses to a crime that you've been dealing with for 20-odd years.
Yeah. And the TICs were such an integral part of a detective's work. I remember, you know, almost every case in my early detective days where your DS would say, you know, is there, particularly when you've got a car thief in or a burglar, they'd say, you know, is there any other TICs that we can put to it? Because it would clear up those cases. And of course, as a crime desk sergeant, you want to clear up as many cases as possible. You want your division to have the lowest rates of outstanding crimes and obviously the most amount of detections. But it does lend itself to the wrong person being caught for those things. And I always remember there was a guy called Chatfield, and he was a prolific car thief in and around Guildford when I was in my early policing days. And almost every car that was stolen and we had reports of, people would say, oh, that's Chatfield again. Well, it became a bit of a ridiculous comment because there was more than Chatfield stealing cars. But of course, the next time he gets nicked, he gets brought in and everyone then goes and TICs the outstanding cars to him. And it cleared it up. But the reality was it didn't resolve the cases and it left people.
It doesn't, because the car thief is still out there. The burglar is still out there. The murderer might still be out there. But, you know, your data, your figures show what a fantastic investigative team you are. You know, it's not a win-win for everybody. It may feel like that way, but, you know, the actual burglar is still burgling. The actual car thief is still stealing. And I think that really is why I always take any confession from anybody that's not done in the proper way with supporting evidence. That's the important word. Oh, important words you used, Mark. You know, it has to be corroborated in some way. It can't just be their word against nobody else's word. You know, so let's do what we meant to do and investigate these things properly, and ultimately that way get everybody having more confidence in the system.
It's quite funny. In my early policing days, all my policing days, not just my early policing days, but it was something I learned from my early policing days that I carried through in the rest for all my interviews, is it very often we'd bring people in and we interview them and they would make admissions. They'd say, well, we did this and did that. And the amount of audio interviews I'd listened to or been aware of that other people had taken where actually they just simply accepted that. But I was always very much taught to go for the points to prove. So we used to have a little blue book, which was a points to prove book, and that used to have all the definitions in. And I'm not sure how it works in policing now, but, you know, we used to learn these definitions. You know, I can still recite theft, you know, dishonestly appropriating property belonging to another with the intention of permanently depriving another of it, you know.
Yeah.
And each of those definitions, each of those elements of a crime
has to be proved.
And that's what's so important for interviews. When even if someone makes an admission, you take them through those points to prove.
Yeah, it's so, you know, if you do it that way, you can't go wrong. You know, time and time again, you've come across, just using theft as an example, you know, they say, look, we can prove that he took it. We can prove that he didn't intend to give it back. And they go, there you go, that's theft. I said, can you prove that it belonged to somebody else?
Yeah.
No, I haven't got the statement from the person. Well, you haven't got a case then. You know, just simply follow the elements of the offense. So it's complicated, but we are only because we make it complicated. Yeah, A, B, C, D, and E, do that and you'll get a conviction. But if you haven't, then it'll be taken apart. And you know, the same thing could be true of drugs. You know, you have to prove possession.
Yeah.
You have to prove it's a drug. You know, they think we got him to bank to run. He admits that it's X, whatever it is. Well, can you prove that he had it in possession? Can you prove that it's a drug? And something, you know, you remember those occasions where somebody thinks he's got a drug and he's actually got, you know, a bag of talcum powder and he's selling that.
And it's funny because there are cases like that. I'm certainly aware of a case where this person genuinely thought they had a drug. And of course, it was so highly mixed that the amount of drug in there was, I think, almost non-existent.
Yeah, non-existent. But then of course, you can prosecute them for attempting to supply because they thought it was. It wasn't. But, you know, if you don't, as you say, follow the elements of the offence, then you're leaving yourself open to the case completely collapsing. And, that's a really good lesson, I think, to anybody that's in investigation and in prosecution, is to just go back to the source material.
Yeah. Now, I found my points to prove book the other day, actually, and it's quite interesting when you look back at it. Of course, some of the legislation has changed slightly now, but the principles of it are all exactly the same.
Well, theft hasn't. Yeah, 1968, it's 50-odd years.
Absolutely.
That it's been exactly the same offence. Yeah. Of course, the government want to introduce an offence of special offence of theft of pets because they think that... some people found it difficult to prove that a pet belongs to somebody. You know, that a pet is a sentient being. Does it actually belong to another? You know, but all right, fine. We'll find gaps in the system and people might exploit them. But at the end of the day, just follow the elements of the offence.
It's an interesting one, that, isn't it? Because when an animal is stolen, and we have seen certainly an increase in the theft of animals since lockdown, dogs in particular, and the amount of cost that a dog is now, you know, they're very expensive, and it is, you can't steal a dog, you can't steal a cat. And I think it's quite an interesting gap in that piece of legislation. I mean, essentially what you ended up having to look at was elements perhaps of criminal damage.
Yeah, I know.
So I do think it is definitely something that's long overdue, and in particular because what ends up happening is that society ends up with offenders. So offenders are always ahead of the legislation. So the offenders commit the crime and then the legislation tries to catch up with the offenders.
Yeah. You find a gap. They find the gaps. We have to plug the gaps. And it becomes like an endless cat and mouse game, literally, isn't it? That's the system we have. I'd prefer this system rather than the draconian, dictatorial, ruthless tyrant, you know, who simply says you're guilty, that's the end of the matter. We should always have to prove our case. You should be innocent until you're proven guilty, and we have to prove it to the right requisite standard. And that protects us all at the end of the day, even if it may sound to some as being a bit onerous.
No, it is. I mean, it's really important we have an adversarial state here in terms of the process. Do you think that we are in a position where we can comfortably say that you are innocent until proven guilty? And I think in particular, when you look at some of perhaps the media coverage of cases and the way that when it gets to court, you kind of effectively now, if you're up in court, many solicitors and barristers will always say to you, well, the Crown has to prove the case. But by and large now, and certainly my experience, is that it is really quite incumbent on you now as the defendant to find the evidence to show that you aren't responsible.
You've always got to, you know, there's a burden on the defendant to prove a defence. So if you're arguing self-defence, for example, you can't simply say, well, the prosecution need to prove that it wasn't self-defence. You've got to give some evidence. Similarly with alibi, you can't simply say, well, I wasn't there, there you go. No, you've got to be able to show some evidence to show you got an alibi. Then it's for the prosecution to disprove that to the right standard. And I think, I personally still think that, we're a system with innocence or proven guilty. We remain that way. The media make it a little bit more difficult, but, you know, usually a long time passes between the initial coverage and the ultimate trial. So I would hope that by that time, the jury will not have been affected by any initial publicity.
And of course, we have a system here where judges can't be influenced, magistrates can't be influenced. But I just wonder sometimes when a case has so much media coverage, how difficult it is for those people in the judiciary to step aside and just ignore all of that.
They're professionals. You know, I've sat with judges who are dealing with really, really horrible cases, and, you know, they don't talk about the case. afterwards, you know, whilst the case is going on. They know what their role and responsibilities are. Of course, we have appeals. People can appeal if they're not happy with the judicial outcome of the judge, how the judges handle the law. So I'm not as worried as perhaps some are. I think it goes back to our broader point about transparency. Why are you and I talking about judges? Judges should be on this podcast talking about judges. Yeah. You know, it always struck me. It always actually, what can I say? It was absolutely horrific to me that every single time a judge made a sentencing decision, the prosecutor had to go on TV and explain why the sentence was issued.
Yes.
Because the judges, we don't do media. This is their regular mantra. And that, I'm afraid, is why people don't know what judges do.
No.
People don't know any judges. You know, I don't want to go down the whole route of the American system where you elect them, but I do think the judges ought to be much more open and available to talk about.
It has got better. It has got better. I remember speaking to a QC friend of mine not long ago, and he was saying, you know, the whole judges process is so many of these come from the same background, they come from the same experience, they work, you know, they're very akin to each other. And the reason he was saying this is it's very difficult sometimes to get a, perhaps there is a potential miscarriage of justice, and it's very difficult to get a judge to change that decision when the very person that they would be changing the decision for and being critical of is someone that they know and someone that's come from their background. And I do think judges, it has got better. It definitely has got better. But there are still, it is still very much a closed shop.
Yeah. I mean, it's the class thing, isn't it? I mean, you've got very few working class judges. You know, they tend to have gone to the same schools, potentially, certainly the same universities.
Yeah.
They mix in the same circles. And the perception you're left with is that they're somehow distant and remote from the people that they deal with. That's something that the judiciary needs to address.
Mm.
As you say, there's much more. They're more diverse now than they ever have been, but they're still a long, long way from where they ought to be. You know, we always talk about being judged by your peers. You know, people who are like you, people who have similar backgrounds to you. That doesn't happen, does it? I mean, you know, your peer, I don't know where you went to university or whether you went to college or not. You know, my judge would be from Birmingham University, who went from inner city Birmingham, you know, where I come from.
Yes.
And the chances of that happening are non-existent, you know. So I think we need judges who are more reflective of the communities that they serve.
Yeah, and I think it's something that's been long overlooked. And the judiciary, from a judge's point of view, really need to take the mantle and run with it, because the very people that are coming before them in the courts, we need to have those people who come from those backgrounds, who can understand what's going on. And we see this sometimes, not always, but, you know, and thankfully, you know, overwhelmingly judges get it absolutely right. But we do see some of the comments sometimes made by judges, and we look at that and we go, that's absolutely wrong. You're living in the past.
Yeah, the old ones, the famous ones are, you know, who are the Beatles, you know, that kind of stuff. Where, well, these days it'd be who's Stormzy. You know, they literally they're not expected to know what's happening in popular culture, but they should be able to be receptive to understanding those kinds of issues, what it is that people are dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And I think unless you are at least engaged in your local communities. And this is where magistrates are better, I think, than judges, because they generally come from their local communities. Then I think you give the perception, or certainly the impression, that you're remote. And if you're remote, well, you know, you don't really get what's happening to me. And that particularly impacts on things like mitigation. When somebody is saying, yes, I committed a particular crime, and these are the reasons why I did, you know, because of the environment I grew up in, the family that I had, the schooling I had. If the judge has no understanding of any of those issues, then the sentence, unfortunately, will be perhaps longer than it should be, because they don't understand the pressures that individual faces. Not excuses, is understanding their pressures. So the real big call from us is to have a much more diverse judiciary.
Yeah, and I think magistrates has massively improved. I go back to 15, 20 years. where I look at it today, and I have to say, I think an incredible amount of work has been done to bring magistrates in from the community, make sure they are diverse and that they're making, you know, the right decisions. That hasn't yet happened with judges. And the other thing that I worry about for judges is not just in terms of living with the current culture and understanding what that is, but also understanding, you know, victims, because, you know, 15, 20 years ago, the attitude for victims was incredibly different than it is now. And I just think that at times that means that the victim's perspective, the understanding of the victims gets lost.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, this is something that I'm personally aware of, is that some judges do spend time with charities that support victims in order to understand the victim's journey. And that's really good. But it's done almost on a personal basis. It's not mandatory. I personally think that if you are dealing with sex offences, for example, you need to spend time with victims of rape and sexual offences by going to talk to the NGOs, the charities that support them. You know, that will give you the kind of understanding and empathy that you do not get from just simply reading about it. And that's true, I think, of pretty much other crimes as well. So the more informed and more aware you are, the better your decision making. It's as simple as that. But it shouldn't be left to individual judges. There is a judicial training program, but there are certain things that should be mandatory. I think one of them is that you meet with victims of crime. In order to understand what it feels like to be a victim of crime, and not simply relying upon what they do right now, which is what they call a victim impact statement, a personal statement, where at the end of a trial, their victim reads how they feel about whatever it is that's happened to them. That's not good enough. You know, that might be good enough for that particular case, but in order to really get into your DNA, you need to spend much more time with victims and survivors.
Absolutely. Well, that brings to a close this week's podcast. We've received an awful lot of emails from people asking us to look at certain different subjects. So what we're going to do is not next week, and I'll explain why not next week, but the week after, we're just going to touch on a number of those different issues. Some of them we can't go into great detail, but we can just have a general roundup around them. But next week, we're going to ask Nick Wallace to come in. Nick Wallace is the investigative reporter who was, I would say, really crucial and central to giving a public profile of the whole post office scandal. He's now written a book, and I'm delighted to say that he's going to join us next week to give us a real understanding of that. We touched on this last week, Nazir, but it is, I still can't get my head around why nobody identified this as being a major problem earlier, both in terms of everybody involved, but it's changed people's lives.
The biggest miscarriage of justice in this country, more than 700 people, and maybe more that we don't even know about, and certainly lives destroyed, people dying, feeling that they've been convicted of a crime that wasn't even carried out. It wasn't a case of
wasn't a crime.
It wasn't a crime that somebody else convicted. It was a crime that wasn't a crime. Yeah. So. Absolutely looking forward to that conversation. We need to really put a shine a light on this. And of course, we've talked before, there needs to be accountability. People need to be held responsible for these terrible miscarriages of justice.
Absolutely. Yep. I couldn't agree with you more. Well, Nazir, as always, thank you so much. You look after yourself this week, and let's get together next week. Take care.
Good. Bye now.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kayes, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.